Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, Park fans. We're a podcast for theme park fans, and we're here every week talking about things going on in the theme park industry and chatting to some interesting people as well. Now, I'm normally with Kev. He's not here. He's over at Disneyland Paris. However, I've got an exciting guest for us on the podcast this week. He's someone who's worked in the UK. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, he was over here at Thorpe Park in Chessington, and we're going to talk all about that. And since then, he's gone on to turn around a theme park, which was kind of on the back burner. It was not doing so well, and he took it from strength to strength. He's also now a leadership coach and consultant, and he consults on the customer experience in attractions. I am delighted to welcome to Parkcast Mark Shaw.
Delighted with that lovely welcome. Thank you so much. It's
a pleasure. Have you ever had such an intro?
Pleasure to be here. And now I'm wondering, do I sound slightly Jason Donovan? Because, you know, Jason is an Australian who's lived in London for the last 17, 18 years. And I'm an Englishman who's been living in Australia for the last 16 years. And whenever I speak to my friends, they go, oh, you're like, oh my God, I literally bumped into Jensen Button in a restaurant in
Perth. Just as you do, just casually.
Yeah, as you do. And my boss I was having dinner with at the time, the boss of the theme park, owner rather, he stopped Jensen on the way to the toilet and he goes, mate, just we've been debating this, are you Jensen Button? And he was like, because this place was like a small restaurant, tapas restaurant in a small suburb of Perth, and we were like, what would Jensen Button be doing in a restaurant like that? So there was a lot of debate about, no, it's a looky-likey, it's a guy that looks a lot like him, and he had this, you know, model like girlfriend with him, but that maybe that was just coincidence. And sure enough, it was Jensen Button, and we had this little conversation that went on for about 20 minutes, and in the end I said, mate, do you need to go to the toilet, right? And then he goes to he replies to me, he goes, mate, where's that accent from? And I go, well, it's from England, obviously. And he goes, ooh, okay.
you sound super Aussie to me. I mean, I definitely still get the UK twang, but you could pass as either.
There you go. But if I hang out with you online long enough, I might just bring the old Englishman back.
Well, hang on. I'm just going to stop you there. I just have to clarify that I am Welsh. So you've just committed the cardinal sin of calling me English, but it's okay. I won't berate you too much for it.
Blimey. Got off to a great start. Yes. From the valley.
But, yeah. That wasn't bad. I'm actually from Newport, which is a bit on Newport, all right.
Bit more like
Gavin and Stacey, but yeah. Hopefully you won't go too far down that road if you speak to me for too long, but we'll see how it goes. We'll find out at the end. There's only one way we can do it.
Oh God, this is already fun.
Right, well, I'm going to move on because we've got a lot to cover and you're a busy man. I'm not. I've got very little to do today, but I don't want to rob too much of your time, and we've got a lot to talk about. So as I mentioned, you were at Thorpe and Chessington, which we're going to talk about, and you turned around completely Adventure World, which is in Perth in Australia, which is a fascinating story, which I'm really looking forward to talking to you about. But as you say, you kind of started things over here in the UK. And was attraction something you were always interested in? Was that where you started your career?
No. I started my career in hospitality. I started as a 14-year-old in a kitchen washing pots and scrubbing potatoes and occasionally having the odd potato thrown at me. Literally happened. And I went from there to becoming a waiter and then a head waiter and then a restaurant manager. And the restaurants got bigger and bigger. And then I went to America and picked up the Dave & Buster's franchise with Bass Leisure. And we brought that back to Birmingham and Bristol. And what Dave & Buster's did for me was broaden my skill set, I suppose, in terms of retail games and amusements, as well as the food and beverage component and entertainment and corporate, I suppose. And Nigel Elliott at the time was the general manager of Chessington, and he was looking for a head of commercial for Chessington. And Nigel actually lived up in Birmingham near Solihull, where Dave & Buster's was, and he used to take his family. And he was a big fan. He was obviously impressed with it's a really great operation. I don't know if you've ever been to a Dave & Buster's in the US, but
I haven't.
So they're like a 50,000 square foot entertainment complex with I suppose, a slightly elevated TGI Friday style food and beverage operation. The cocktail waitress is everywhere. It's legendary service, ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. They're brilliant at what they do, actually, and I learned a fair bit. But so Nigel was a fan, and he was struggling to find somebody who had that experience of food and beverage, retail, amusements, sideshow games, that kind of stuff. And after a while in search, I think he went back to the recruitment agency, I can't remember which one it was, and said, I'm looking for a Dave and Buster's kind of person. And about a week later, I went in, because I was looking for a new challenge, I went into the same recruitment agency, and they said, oh, we might have a job for you. And, you know, cut a long story short, I was offered the role, and it was quite a step up for me. Like, theme park in terms of scale of operation, I had, you know, 500 or 600 employees, I think, probably then at Chessington. And I was kind of in that sort of fake it till you make it mode. I remember the first couple of months, I was thinking they're going to work me out. And I realized that they've kind of brought this guy and he doesn't know what he's doing. But the opposite was true, and it went really, really well. And I got some, I guess I picked off some low-hanging fruit and got some great results. I remember we had a really bad summer, as you do in the UK. Well, our attendances were not sideways. And I was fortunate enough to get results in terms of the commercial income such that we managed to make up the gap. And so when Chessington then, a few months later, Glenn Earlham had come down from Alton Towers and became my new boss. And then we bought Thorpe Park as effectively a defensive move because we didn't want to, you know, a competitor buying the park. And Thorpe had the advantage of no treetop sort of planning restrictions for building tall rides. And there was pretty much an immediate restructure. They created a new senior management team that oversaw both parks. And I suddenly found myself going from this moment where I thought, oh gosh, this is a bit of a step up, I'm doing Chessington. And then suddenly, within about seven or eight months, I picked up Thorpe Park as well.
Wow.
And Thorpe was, you know, Thorpe had been bled dry basically by Ready Mix Concrete and was in dire need of investment, which obviously was then Two Swords right before it became Merlin. We're prepared to had the money to invest. And so suddenly not only am I trying to optimize the commercial side of Chessington, but I've got all these major projects at Thorpe happening that I'm getting involved in. So Colossus, the first, you know, 10 looping roller coaster, it's a bit of a stretch, but anyway. and
we'll make an enthusiast out of you. Yeah, Mark.
Sorry. No, I love rides. We'll come back to my love of rides in a bit, but you know, got these projects. So I'm building a warehouse because we're expanding the volume at Thorpe. Right? We know we've got the infrastructure needs to be supporting of that. We've got a 2 million, what was at the time, I think, a £2 million food and beverage project. Today's money is probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 million. It was quite a long time ago. And then I picked up Beano Land at Chessington because Chris Welsh had left and he was the project champion for Beano Land. And suddenly I'm running the Beano Land project halfway through. And I managed to get through my first project meeting where, again, I feel like I'm faking it, right? Because I've never done this before. I've got all these smart people around the table, including John Wardley, right?
Oh,
and
the legend.
And I remember going through the entire project meeting. And then at the end of it, we're doing a whip round any other business. And John pipes up and he goes, I can't believe nobody's talked about landscaping.
Classic, yeah, John.
Yeah. Typical John, sitting there in, you know, his flying jacket, his leather flying jacket, trademark flying jacket. And I thought, you know, he's bloody right because landscaping, from a value perspective, the cost of landscaping is so marginal, but it does add so much to it. And I've remembered that in every project that I've done ever since.
Yeah,
one of the most cost effective way to elevate any kind of area in a park, and in Australia we're very lucky that things grow pretty quickly, so you can do great stuff with landscaping here. Jamboree and Adventure World, both really good examples of that, I think, with Jamboree in particular. done great things with the landscaping where they actually create a bit of a journey for people and a bit of a reveal as that opens up, and they just use tall landscaping for that. And it's so much softer than the hard sort of concrete and you know, a lot of the parks, Disney included, Universal Studios, some of the Gold Coast parks here, there's a lot of facades, right, with just painting on them, and they just, and concrete, and it's very hard. But when you get parks that are blended in landscaping beautifully, it really softens it.
Yeah, no, so, absolutely. It's interesting as well, because actually the most recent addition to Thought with Hyperia has got a lot of criticism from enthusiasts for its lack of landscaping. So maybe we need to wheel John Wardley back into those discussions so you can go and sort that out.
Sometimes it's a budget thing and you just...
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. Yeah.
Or sometimes they plant really small stuff that takes two, like effectively it's going to take 2 or 3 years for it to mature.
I don't see any sort of saplings around that site. I just see a lot of overgrown grass. But that's probably maybe a later discussion. We'll come on to how things are and where things go. There's a lot to unpick there. One of the first things I just want to say is you mentioned obviously becoming head of commercial. What exactly does that job involve? How far does your scope kind of hit with that position?
Yeah, it's good to clarify. So it's effectively getting as much money out of people's pockets once they're inside the park.
Okay.
So that's vending, food and beverage, retail, sideshow games, amusements, sponsorship. What am I missing? Ride photography.
Right, yeah.
It's all of that across those two parks, which, I'm slightly competitive and kind of target orientated. So there's nothing better than, you know, a daily sort of perusal through all the spend numbers and then going, right, how do I get this? How do I get the spend up?
Yeah.
Right. And challenging the teams to do that. So that was just really great fun.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much fun as running a theme park and being across everything. And that was, I suppose, there was a sort of point with Merlin where that's what I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
But didn't get the opportunity, unfortunately.
And with that, you know, you like you say, I mean, your job is to extract money from us. And I think as enthusiasts, we're sometimes very aware of that feeling of you're just trying to drain me, bleed me dry. Did you notice an absolute link between people being willing to spend more money when they're having a better time?
100%. And there's some things you can control and there's some things you can't. So you can't control the weather, right?
No.
And it's funny, I remember with Walls Ice Cream, who are our supplier for all our ices, 23 degrees and above, sales start climbing. It's literally at 23. Anything below that, forget it. In Perth, that's probably 28 degrees. But the other things like ride closures, for example, if there are two or three rides, major rides down, the retail spend will be affected. Yeah, because, you know, people haven't had a great time, so why would they buy a souvenir?
Yeah.
They're kind of feeling a bit robbed, right?
Yeah.
Because as far as they're concerned, they've paid to get in and do all the rides, and that's what they're expecting. And so the moment they get a bit disappointed, it definitely affects their willingness, their keenness to give you their money. So you are reliant on, and, you know, back in the day, Chessington, I think in particular, had quite a lot of ride issues at the time. The Vampire was really troublesome. I want to call it Rampage. That's the Adventure World equivalent. Oh, Ramses' Revenge. Thank you. Problematic. There was some real legacy stuff that we, as a senior management team, picked up from years, I think, of poor maintenance or I don't know, ride procurement maybe was part of the program as well. You know, you probably know, eventually we ended up changing out the trains and making some other amendments to the Vampire with the Vekoma upgrade. And that's just celebrated. I saw it celebrate its birthday, a milestone birthday recently.
And
John was back there.
He was there. We spoke to him on the podcast the day before he went down. And he chatted to us about Vampire and the Bubble Works and all of that. Yeah, I mean, I could chat to him for weeks and I still wouldn't have answers to all my questions, but
he's something special.
Yeah, he is, we said, can you imagine a world where John Wardley didn't exist and the attractions that we wouldn't have today if if John Wardley had never got into the world of theme parks. It's crazy to think of the legacy he's left behind. But yeah, and it's amazing, you know, it's testament to him that that ride still, you know, is as loved today as it was back when it opened in the early 90s. But
yes, I do remember though. I do remember, and I should probably say, going back to your question about, you know, did I want to get involved with attractions? I'd never really been to theme parks before I worked in them, and I remember getting there and going, and I remember looking at Samurai and going, "You're not getting me on that, right?" And then I remember talking to the head of maintenance, Ian, can't remember his last name, and he was kind of reassuring me about the dual redundancy and the more I listened to them, the more I thought, you know what, this is probably going to be okay. You should do it. And so eventually they get me up on the Samurai, and Russell Barnes was in the ops team at the time. He told the ride operator to put me on the longest cycle possible.
That's nice of him.
Yes. So not only was it a baptism of, you know, my first major sort of hardcore ride, but it wouldn't stop. And I was just feeling really sick, turning green. And then I get off, and Russell's just cracked up laughing. And I'm like, "You bastard." But since then, I've, you know, you just want more and higher and faster and, you know, awesome rides. I love it. I absolutely love it.
The
There's no
Bugatti.
better sensation than flying through the air, upside down, sideways, not
Yeah.
knowing where your head is at, and all the dopamine, and it's amazing.
It's addictive. I mean, it's why we're here. It's why this podcast exists, because we
Well,
all got
yeah.
addicted to that, chasing those endorphins from a theme park.
And I remember going back to your John Wardley point, going to Alton Towers and then going on Oblivion. And you know, you get to the top and then it sort of circles around and then you stop like that. And I remember thinking, "John Wardley, you're a sick man. Like, just honestly, what are you doing to me?" And then as I fly into this hole in the ground, and then I thought, "Wow, that was pretty special, actually."
Well, I talk about this because I'm guessing you're talking about back in 98 or around that time. And Oblivion's kind of overlooked now, especially for younger enthusiasts who are just getting into, but you know, theme parks and stuff like that. Oblivion's never highly rated really amongst them at all. But for us who remember it being built and being constructed, I remember that first time we saw a vertical drop. A roller coaster had never done that before. It was like,
No.
what is that track doing?
What are you doing?
Yeah, it was crazy, and I wish we could relive that moment of that, because it's now it's like, oh yes, Oblivion, but it's really hard to explain what a big deal that roller coaster was when it opened. And like you say, that the hold, which now unfortunately, you know, you don't get that hold for as long, and the audios had to be got rid of because of the residents and things like that, so you don't get that full experience anymore. But when you rode it in 1998, that coaster was breathtaking. The drop still takes me away, takes my breath away every time I ride it.
I also began my, I guess, love affair with B&M coasters, because they're just incredible, and the sound, the swooshing sound that
Roar,
a B&M,
yeah.
you can hear it in a park somewhere, and you just go, "Oh, my hairs are going up now just thinking about it. How funny. I've got a pilar
Really?
erection. Yeah, my hairs are go literally going up as I think about just some of the amazing B&M coasters, and it's just like there's no other coaster like it. No steel coaster anyway, I don't think.
Yeah, they
Even though I
are.
didn't get to build one. They're too
Well,
expensive, but
there's still time. There's still time. Another interesting part then, actually, we're talking about Oblivion, and this has been a debate that's raged amongst enthusiasts, and you might be able to add your two pence into this, is from the commercial partnerships point of view, so a sponsorship point of view. And I've worked in radio a long time, and I've worked in the commercial side of radio where we have to sell sponsorships, we have to make money for the radio station. And there's a fine line, isn't there, between taking the money from the client who wants to spend it and destroying your product.
Absolutely. You know, being head of commercial, right? So, and the Colossus is probably a really good example. It's very heavily themed at the time, and Coca-Cola want to get their presence in there. And I'm dealing with dear friend Kathy Meese from Two Swords Studios at the time, who was doing most of the Chessington Thorpe design stuff. And bless her, you know, I was basically the middleman between what the sponsor wants
Yeah.
and quite rightly knowing that you need a certain amount of presence to to trigger sales, right? People need to see the product.
Yeah.
People need to see the product. But Kathy wanted to package it up and the theme in such a way that you couldn't see the product. So I had to find this happy middle ground where, that works. And, you know, I'd sit and have these great conversations with Kathy about how we could make that work. And, and she'd be like, I guess I could do that. I go, yes, let's do that. And then eventually we'd take it back to Coke and they'd go, that'll work.
Yeah.
The sales worked, you know.
Yeah.
And it all blended in. But there's quite a bit of work that goes into that, right? Trying
to just
balance those things. So it does commercially work, but it does, you know, it doesn't set out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
And spoil the, you know, because the beauty of the whole thing is the theming, right?
Well, this is where
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. The old Oblivion Fanta sponsorship, which was probably after you'd left Merlin Tussauds by that point,
but that was the one.
It was you know, you've got this really forbidding, like, apocalyptic coaster, which is all like, this is really dangerous, and then you've got Fanta, and it's just stickers of Fanta everywhere.
Yeah,
it's like it's tropical fun,
and the color. Well, the color.
Well, that's where they went for
the orange and
that's it. It was like, oh, it's orange. It was like the most basic link that you could have formed. Oh, Fanta's orange, Oblivion's orange. Yeah, let's just stick the two things together. And it's like, you just wish there was a bit more thought on actually how can we integrate a sponsorship in a better way. And maybe those two things are just never going to go together and we find another avenue for Fanta somewhere else in the park, because it's going to affect your customer experience to the point where you're like, oh, that's the ride aura has been kind of ruined by that.
Absolutely. But,
It's interesting to hear from someone who's been in those conversations, though, and has had those debates and had to find where, okay, we've got this money on the table. Where do I put it? I've got to take it. How do I keep my creative team happy? And how do I make that work?
Yeah. Beano Land was a really good example of that as well. And, you know, you're trying to marry the desires of Thompson, DC Thompson Comics and, those guys, you know, Scottish guys come down and they're just like, just love a dram of whiskey at lunchtime in a meeting, you know.
Classic.
Let's get the whiskey, you know, let's have it. And I'll be like, okay.
Well, then the creative ideas are going to flow after that. So I can imagine it all went well.
Possibly. Sometimes it goes the other way. I've done some of my best work after a few glasses of wine.
We all have, Mark. The other thing I needed to pick you up on is, obviously, you mentioned one of my heroes, Glenn Earlham, who was behind the big marketing campaign for Oblivion and really created some of that hype for us, and you worked with him. He is someone that I have respected for such a long time, and with a marketing brain.
Yeah, 100%. He was something quite unique in terms of his leadership. And he's only about 4 or 5 years older than me. But God, he was really impressive. The way he picked up that team and built the new senior management team. And then I guess he drove a sort of cultural change in terms of operations, right? So holding people accountable for, you know, the maintenance issues at Chessington. I think they had, you know, they were sort of better sorted at Thorpe historically. But and things like, you know, how do we elevate in terms of the park presentation, right? Because particularly Chessington at the time was attracting a lot of teenagers from sort of South London, and because it's on the train line, right? Mm-hmm. So you get hordes of teenagers coming in and they trash the place, the litter everywhere, right? And because there's a team of litter pickers that are doing their job, but nobody else is helping them, supporting them. And one of the first things that Glenn rightly did, and I guess he probably bought this from Bolton Towers, was instill this idea that nobody walks past the litter, and Glenn would be bending down, all 6 foot, whatever he is, of Glenn Earlham, sort of bending down to pick up the tiniest piece of litter. And, you know, I would be doing the same, and then Chris Edge would be doing the same, and, you know, whoever else is in the senior management team. Because we knew that when if we're not doing it, how do we get the rest of the team to do it? And eventually, after a period of time, it did spread, and it spread throughout the whole team. And that was something that I very much took to Adventure World and instilled. And I would say, you know, I say when I'm talking to people about, you know, the work and you know, the success, I suppose, of a project like Adventure World, and I always think of them as like projects. It's only because I've worked with people like Glenn and others, and John Wardley, and great people, Russell Bond, and Clegg in marketing. Beautiful people, love great people, and you just kind of you can't help but soak it up because they're so impressive. And you go, well, I'm definitely taking that with me, right? Those tips, that way of managing, that style. I mean, I remember in the first sort of year of Glenn taking over, we were all hands to the pump, like flat out busy with all these projects and work. And it was, I was 32, 33. I had so much kind of energy. And I was single, I didn't mind working 15-hour days, whatever, just to get the job done. But Glenn had this thing about going home on time every night. He'd be like 5:30, 6 at the very, very latest. I'm out of here. I've got a family at home. This is and sending a really good message out to everybody else that, like, hey, it's you don't have to work. Like, well, yeah, it's got sense. Yeah, like I said, I think there's just some great people that I've worked with along the way that you do. You'd be stupid not to learn from these people and sort of, Mark Shaw is the product of a bundle of probably 20 to 30 other people's great work that I've just kind of stolen their ideas from.
And then I'm sure there's people who then would say the same about you, and they go, "Well, I've learned stuff from Mark, and I've taken that with me to other places." So the cycle continues.
Goes on, yeah. Well, I hope so. I hope so. I always sort of think, my passion for the guest experience, customer experience, depending on, whatever industry you're in, is about giving value to people and creating light and joy, whether that's a working experience as an employee or as a customer or guest. That, why wouldn't you if you can? Why wouldn't you do that the best way you possibly can do it? I didn't articulate that very well, did I? But do you know what I mean? It's like, if I'm going to get out of bed and I'm going to do this work, forget about the money and the domestic stuff, the bonuses. I've never been motivated by that. I just mo get motivated by doing the very best that you can and enjoying it along the way, and really like emphasis on enjoy it, right? Because the I think my time in the parks has never felt like work. It never felt like work. And when people say to me, oh, you're the luckiest guy in the world to be like running a theme park when I eventually got to Perth, I'm like, yeah. I struggle to think of better jobs.
That's
I mean,
amazing, though.
there's some boring shit in there as well. Spreadsheets and health and safety stuff, which is obviously, it's vitally important, but it's not the most exciting.
And do you still keep
Good
in touch with
memories.
these guys now, or
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do. But I met Glenn and Russell when they first came over to Australia when Merlin were looking to purchase, what was it, L Living Life Australia? I can't remember what the business was called at the time. But and we actually talked about potentially my coming back on board in some capacity. But I'd already been offered the job at Adventure World, and they were offering. I remember telling Glenn what they would offer me, and he was like, Jesus. You don't pay our senior managers that much. And it was like, oh, okay, all right. Well, Merlin's a big corporate, and they kind of do. I shouldn't talk badly of them, but is there any? I think a lot of theme park businesses, they tend to leverage the fact that people love working in them to the degree that they then don't necessarily pay the right salaries, I don't think, in a lot of roles. That's kind of taking advantage of people's softness for theme parks. That doesn't seem to be the case in Australia. They just seem to pay very well.
You've got a huge responsibility when you're running a theme park. You've got a responsibility to your staff, but also hundreds and thousands of guests every single year. And I don't want someone to be in that position being underpaid. I want someone who is being paid their worth to be looking after my experience and my well-being when I'm visiting a theme park.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think so. Fun times, just great period of time. Made some great friends.
Attractions people, you all seem to kind of spread the world and move around, and you are not, you're nomads really, and you'll kind of go where the next challenge is. And obviously that happened to you. So you were at Thorpe and Chessington till about 2004, is that right? And then you moved on.
Yes, I did. It was funny because I'd had this conversation with Glenn about doing an MBA. Because I'd skipped university. My parents weren't, big fans. They hadn't gone to university. I've got four siblings. None of them went to university. The ethos was you put, get your head down, work hard, and you'll be successful. You don't need to go to university. And kind of felt like there were times, particularly I remember with Dave & Buster's at Battle Leisure, they had a graduate program where people were fast tracking, and I was like, I don't really get this because I'm kind of feel like I'm just as intelligent as you and just as capable, but for some reason you're jumping ahead of me because you
Do I
went to
have a piece of
university.
paper?
That's right. So eventually I was like, sod it, I want to do an MBA. And I remember going to Glenn, and his initial response was, yeah, okay, well, let I think we can do that, right? And I was like, oh, okay, great, fantastic. And then eventually he goes, I remember having another meeting with him, and he goes, Mark, if I pay for your MBA, I've basically taken up the whole development budget for the parks, right, in one go, so we can't do it. And I got tapped on the shoulder by Whitbread, David Lloyd Leisure, and they said, we will pay for it, we'll pay for you. So I went and ran the flagship David Lloyd in Wimbledon, near Wimbledon, Raynes Park, and they paid for my MBA.
Oh, amazing. Didn't Glenn end up at David? Was it David
He
Lloyd?
did, yes, and
That's
Russell.
who,
How
there you go.
funny. Talk about full circle.
You started that one then. You start.
Just bizarre.
They're obviously
I
tapping
think,
up theme park people.
well, I mean, it just goes to show you the fundamentals, I guess, of, running a successful attraction or theme park are transferable to a lot of different I industries. And then eventually I moved to Australia. Met a girl from Melbourne and moved over here, and then the job came up in Perth. I almost didn't get the job because the guy who was doing the recruitment had, I think he had one of those sort of old school trays on his desk, where people put documents in, and there's like
Oh,
two, three levels, and he put my CV in there. And I'd applied for the job thinking I probably got quite a good chance at like getting an interview for this at least. And I hadn't heard anything for weeks. I remember being at my local Westfield shopping centre with my wife, and about to get in the car, and I go, I'm just going to call this guy because it just feels weird to me. Call him, and sure enough, he goes, Mark Shaw, I don't seem to have. We said, we're down to the last three candidates already, so probably a bit late, probably a bit late. And I said, well, you've got my CV, right? And he's like, hang on a second. And then he starts fiddling around in this, tray, and he pulls out, and he looks at it, and he goes, oh yeah, we probably should have a look at you actually. And then within a couple of days later, they'd organised a phone interview, and then it was like, right, need to go on an airplane and fly over Melbourne to Perth. And I spent a day there, met the board, did a walk around the park, got ferried back to the airport. I didn't know anything about Perth at all, and then suddenly they offered me the job, and I'm like, okay, all right, well, I'm going to take it because
Wow.
I saw in this park a just golden opportunity to add value from my experience, I suppose. And it felt like it was at that sort of stage where it really needed somebody with that experience to take it to the next level.
It was, wasn't it at the time, it was Australia's second lowest rated theme park. So this wasn't a successful theme park that you're walking into. This is somewhere that's like, okay, we're struggling.
It was, yeah. Out of a competitor set of about, I don't know, 10 or 12, I can't remember. But that includes amusement parks, water parks, theme parks, in general, obviously the Gold Coast parks here.
What was going wrong at Adventure World at the
Oh
time?
God, that's a really good question. I think operationally it wasn't great. The presentations weren't great. I think there were some ride issues. In terms of maintenance was an issue, definitely. None of it was really trying to think what was going well.
That's a good start, isn't it?
But
What
you know,
was working?
I well, landscaping was definitely working. This is a 32-year-old park at the time, and they
Okay.
whoever put it together had put in some beautiful landscaping.
John would have been happy.
He would. So that was a really great, and lawns as well. It's quite unique, Adventure World, because it does have a lot of lawns and landscaping. So it does have that softness to it. And you can build, and you could definitely build on that, right? So obviously we did. But I remember walking around thinking, this has got so much potential and it's all upside. And I want to be involved in a project where there's upside and you can make the improvements, because that's fun, right? I don't want to be a caretaker manager just coming in every day and opening up and, making sure that all the compliance stuff's done and tick the boxes and do an audit and then, walk out. I want to go in there and go, right, how can we make this 10 times better? And so sort of had that opportunity written all over it, and a board, and being family owned, it was able to be very agile. They were prepared to invest every spare dollar of free cash effectively at the end of the year back into the park. So it was at the, and it was at that unique point where they'd been doing that for quite, well, ever since they bought the park out of administration. And the pot had gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and it was starting to snowball to a size where, the year that I started, they put a Kahuna Falls in, and that was 3.3 million Aussie dollars rain fortress. I think the second largest rain fortress you can get. And then we were able to bank a little bit of money, have a quiet year with Dragon's Kingdom, and then been through a bit of a lengthy process trying to convince the board that we needed to put a roller coaster in, and we needed a maximum impact ride to change the local perception of Adventure World being a bit of a what the journalists locally would call a fun park, which the board hated, the family owners hated, I hated. But I remember saying to them, "We like if we want to be treated seriously, if you look at the research, if people think of a theme park, they think of roller coasters." When we actually did a piece of research about what is your definition of a theme park, what's involved, and they go, the amount of times a roller coaster came up, and the last Adventure World had a traveling roller coaster, Turbo Mountain, but it had been scrapped because it was at the end of its life, and about 5 years earlier, I think. So it hadn't had a roller coaster for quite a while, and I had to convince them to splash out a budget that started out about 8 million and end up being 10.5,
That's a
which
size
is
for a
pretty good.
coaster.
Well, it's pretty. I think it was good value for money. I mean, the Abyss is more or less a copy of Saw, right?
Okay, so
It's a it's a
it's a
Ger it's a
Eurofighter.
Gerstlauer Eurofighter. Yep, slightly different design. Not very d dissimilar, but starts inside the building, has the drop, does the corkscrew, and then out through the tunnel, and then that vertical lift. It's yeah, but that started a strategy of maximum impact attractions that went on through what was next, Kraken, and then Goliath. They couldn't be half-assed sort of new product. It needed to be big, right? And it needed to have that sort of claim to be bigger than. So I remember the Kraken, for example, was at the time, that I don't know if it still is, the tallest, steepest, longest tornado water slide in the world. And we ended up, because we built it from the top of a hill right from the very back of the park and took it all the way down to the bottom. I think it was like a 30-meter drop from top to bottom. And we had to put like an extra 10 meters on the run just to make sure we could claim that from a marketing perspective, just to go, and that's the sort of things you learn at places like Thorpe Park, where you're dealing with, a ride like Colossus, and they're spinning this idea, no pun intended, that it's the world's first 10 looping roller coaster. But it didn't actually loop 10 times. There were 10 inversions because of the
Inverted it,
corkscrew. Yeah, but not 10 loops, right? But they got away with it, right? And that's the kind of thing you have to do, sort of, get people's attention. So.
It's interesting from with you having that experience of trying to create immediate impact, because one of the things that John said on this podcast is that that's one of his sort of his pet hates was he was obviously fighting against this sometimes, where he was the creative brain and he wanted to come up with a concept and a backstory and a really creative execution, but he also had the marketing guys or the money guys saying, well, I just need the tallest because that's what's gonna sell me park admission. So is that something that you genuinely you saw if you tried to market a ride which didn't have a world's first or a USP, that actually just people didn't care?
I mean, the Abyss wasn't that. I mean, it was an expensive ride, and it was a proper roller coaster and fully themed. I remember doing research, actually. There's a guy who wrote a book about who's a research analyst at the Efteling, and he'd basically done a thesis on ROI on attractions and ROI on a plain roller coaster, an amusement park without any theming, and then a roller coaster or a product ride with theming. And the difference they found was, I think the average attendance increase for a ride without theming was something like 7%, 6-7%, something like that. And a ride with theming averaged about 13%. And I remember in his book, he'd got a table of the top 10 parks in the world based on attendance, and seven of them out of 10 were theme parks versus amusement parks. And it sort of tells its own story, right? I mean, people want that depth and the immersive experience, the story, the backstory. And I remember Abyss was originally called The Curse or something, and then the son of the owner was a bit sort of nervous about. We first had a blowout on the project on the cost, and he was like, "I didn't know that we should really like stick with this curse ride name because I feel like we're being cursed."
Tempting
So we
fate.
changed it to Abyss. We changed it to Abyss and came up with these faceless hooded druidic monks or whatever they are, druidic creatures. And that whole idea of faceless, it's just, the face identifies you, right? As soon as you take someone's face out, it doesn't matter what else you see, you're not going to identify them. And it's kind of really spooky, that black hole in where the face should be. And what a cheap, r really effective theme, right? For a park that is effectively trying to deliver a $20 million roller coaster on a $12 million budget, you've got to think outside the box in terms of how do you deliver that relatively inexpensively. But also, golden rule of thumb with theming is it has to be ageless. It can't age. It can't be a theme that ages. How many times have you seen a theme park put a product in that's like, the hot in the 1980s that suddenly it's just like really not? But if you go with a druidic sort of these druidic priests without faces, they'll be relevant in 50 years' time, right? They're just not gonna age. I embraced the theming, even though there were others that were advising against it because it's adding cost and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, you can get great theming. We got great theming out of the Philippines, right? And funnily enough, my engineering and maintenance manager, Chris Stimson, who's a great, great guy, he left Adventure World not long after I did, and he ended up in the Philippines making theming, and in fact contributed to the Star Wars area because they had such a massive project on there that I think they were contracting two or three different theming companies, and he's ending up doing the Star Wars stuff. So, and it's anything that comes out of the Philippines is relatively affordable, let's say. And we had great fun putting together the backstory and the theme for Dragon's Kingdom, for example, because Dragon's Kingdom had to be, it was a $1 million refurb of a kid's pre-primary school area of the park. And $1 million doesn't go very far. But we ended up creating these characters, Yarly the dragon, Yarly the lovable dragon, his sister Yarlet, his grandfather Yarald, and the evil queen Yefiri. And Yarly's problem was he couldn't breathe fire. So Queen Yefiri in Dragonia, his homeland, kicks him out. She says, "You're no good to us. What use is a dragon that can't do fire, right? She's not going to get a part in Game of Thrones." So this lovable blue dragon leaves with his sister and his grandfather Yarald, his little walking stick, and Flossie the fairy, and they find their way to Adventure World where, because he doesn't breathe fire, he only breathes smoke, but these smoke rings turn into love hearts. So Yarly spreads love wherever he goes, and that's his main, that's his thing, right? That's it. That's what he brings to the world. And so he, finds his new home at Dragon's Kingdom and Adventure World, and he spreads his love. And you get the characters in the show, and all the rides are themed. And we went
All the
medieval, which is a little bit
merchandise.
tricky in Perth, but yeah. And it really brings it to life in a way that just doing rides without doesn't. People want that kind of story in the show and the entertainment. It's fun.
Was that something when you first arrived at the park and you obviously you said you've been given this job and it was obviously a big task. Did you immediately go, right, I know exactly what we need to do. I can straight off see that we need to do X, Y, Z, or were you like, hang on, right, I need to get my bearings here for a while and work out what this park particularly needs, maybe compared to other parks that I've previously worked at?
Yeah, I think I kind of knew, and I think I knew the size of the opportunity. But it was, but at the same time, it was a process of taking people on the journey to have confidence and conviction, and that is the right strategy. There was a lot of debate about theming, for example. There was a lot of debate about do we really want to invest B on this roller coaster, and because that's a big leap, right, for a small family, well, family run business. So I think, and again, I'm sort of drawing on memory, right? I can't exactly remember what was going through my mind at the time, but I knew there was some low hanging fruit. I knew there was a lot of operational stuff that needed improving, particularly around the employee experience and recruitment and recognition and reward and benefits for employees, right? Just kind of looking after the employees that they would look after us and elevate. And I think it was probably 2 years before I'd really fully got the confidence of the board such that they would go, yes, okay, we're going to do that, right? Let's do more of that. And there were some baby steps along the way. I mean, so for example, you know, I think in the first year I managed to get a little bit of my extra money for training, but then eventually we ended up doubling our training budget, which was significant for us in terms of and I remember sort of giving the example of Disney. I don't know if it's still true, but pretty much remember that Disney were typically putting 3% of their revenues back into training as part of their budget. That's their budget metric. And when I looked at our budget initially, it was less than 1%. And then we doubled it to 2%. Right? We never got to 3%, but that was still pretty major. And we ended up, I think, going from 16 training hours per employee to 32. And that makes a huge difference in terms of their confidence, their ability, ride throughput, right, batching, look, all of that efficiency piece is massively impacted. So
We had Francis Jackson on the podcast, and you know, he talked about all this, and obviously he's operations, and he said it would take, he was like, when you get a new team running a ride, it's like a junior football team, and they're all just running around, and it's chaos for the first 6 weeks until they all know what they're doing. But part of his ethos is you've got to invest in those people, because once they know what they're doing, like technically with the ride, and that's running like clockwork, then they can allow the customer experience bit
Elevate.
to come in.
Yeah,
Because before that, they're so focused on the on
that's
I've got to get operate
exactly.
this ride that they
Yeah, that's
can't consider
exactly.
the customer.
No, that's exactly right. And I think that sort of part of that ethos came from my hospitality background as well, because, you know, again, like Dave and Buster's, you had to shadow, if you were going to be a waiter in a Dave and Buster's, you have to shadow somebody for like 6 weeks before you're let on your own. And the amount of tests that they do on product knowledge and everything else. But what you end up with at the end of that is a person who doesn't even have to think about it. They just go, right, this is the ingredients, this is the cocktail, this is what you want, this is the wine, this is, I tell you about the wine. And then their personality is allowed to come out because they don't have to think about, they're not concentrating on the function part. They're just going, hey guys, how are you? Yeah, you're having a great time. You know, what's your favorite ride? Where have you come from? Oh my God. You know, it's because the functional part's second nature.
We don't see it so much in the UK, and I think, you know, we talked about this with France as well, about how it's often not seen as a long-term job to go and work in a theme park for the UK in the
I
UK, and your
remember,
parents will
yeah.
be sort of saying, well, we get a real job. It's not seen as a real job, so therefore it's hard to invest the time where you get to that stage of this is now second nature, and now I'm a really welcoming, friendly person. And like you say, that massively impacts your customer experience scores. If they've gone to a theme park and it's been a bit rubbish operationally, but also the staff haven't been great and they've been a bit unfriendly to them, their score is going to be so much lower.
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk about five-star employees, and I sort of relate that back to five-star reviews, right? And in my work as a consultant now, I regularly speak to people and I ask them, what percentage of your frontline team, I don't like the word staff, frontline team members, would you say are five-star? The people that are regularly getting compliments and reviews, they're being named because people want to name them. They're just the kind of people you love working side by side with. Right, as an employee, and you probably wouldn't mind being stuck on a desert island with them for the rest of your life because they've just got that lovely warm disposition. It's easygoing. It's gonna be fine. It's gonna be great. And the answer I get back generally ranges anywhere between 15 and 25%. And then I go, well, so what you're telling me is 75 to 85% of your staff are not staff. I said staff. So of your team are not five star. How do you expect to deliver five star experiences? And they go, oh, yeah, okay, that's a fair point. And then you get the usual excuses of, oh, it's really hard in this area to recruit people and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, you know what? It is in Perth too, right? It's a population of 2 million, and the park's half an hour south of the city in the suburbs. So we've got to find 500 employees. And we did, and we built a team eventually. So when I first started, we were probably hiring one in every 1.5 people that turned up for the recruitment process. 6 years later, we were only taking one in seven people for a casual role. And that meant we could turn away six people. And that's a lot of work, right? Because effectively, even though we had a percentage of returning team members each season, because it's a seasonal park, we probably needed about 250 to 300 new team members. And so if you're only taking one in seven, that's over 2,000 people you're going through an audition process as a filter, and then the one-to-ones, and they've had the phone conversation at the beginning. It's a long, long process, and it requires a great deal of investment in time by the people, like the team, to make that happen. But as we went through it each year, and we gradually increased that ratio from one in 1.5 to 1 in 3 to 1 in 4, 1 in 5, eventually 1 in 7, you see the elevation of the quality of people, and it's incredible. And we ended up with 70% of our, and I know this because we tracked and gave a rating to all of the casual team members. They were either a 4 or a 5 after 3 months, and a few threes got sort of taken off the roster. But the 4s and 5s, so 70% of them were five star employees, and the 4s were sort of lifting because they could see best practice, and they could see how much fun they were having with it, and how that was impacting positively the guest experience. And it was really funny when we launched Abyss. Ed Dickinson, who's the founder of the Australian Roller Coaster Club, called it the best roller coaster in Australia at the time. And I remember Ross, my number two, and I were just like thrilled with this, and it was amazing. We had a great launch party, and we were getting great reviews and so on. And then we started clocking, because we had a really sort of tight focus on reading reviews every day, right? What are the reviews saying? The reviews were saying our team members were amazing, right? And very rarely saying anything about the roller coaster. And then, of course, you realize that, well, our marketing team had done a great job. They won best digital campaign for the Abyss with an amazing teaser campaign, and we had faceless druids in stadiums watching football games and shopping centers and all popping up on Instagram. It was brilliant. And so people knew that there was a great roller coaster. They had that level of expectation. What they weren't expecting was these high five moments with the team members who were engaging with them all the time throughout the entire journey, from the car park through to the rides. When our ride operator was going through a cycle, when the ride's going through its cycle, we hired the kind of people, and then we gave them the kind of guidance to go talk to these people right while they're in the queue. Ask them, what's your favorite ride? Ask them where they've come from. Ask them if they've been to Adventure World before. Start a conversation and have a con the other people within the queue would have conversations with other people. They would go, oh, we're from Mandurah as well, right? Which school do you go to? And you'd start this. And it was like, when I first arrived at Adventure World, there was none of that. They served people, transactional stuff. It wasn't go out of your way to find a way to make somebody's day. That was completely different. And so when you marry that with product and what I call pristine park presentation, PPP, that, landscaping, the litter, that, we'd have 7,000 to 8,000 people in the park, and at 5 to 5, the place would be spotless, and people would be coming up just going, how do you do this? This place looks amazing. Because every single person in the team was picking up litter, right? And we employed a painter, and the painter would come in if there was a scratch on a rail, or everything was touched up. We had a thematic painter, James, who would come in and do any kind of theming painting that needed to be. But just it wasn't acceptable for that standard to drop. And I'm of the belief, I think it's really I kind of ironic when people do a launch party for a new area, or a launch party for a new restaurant, or there's a VIP moment where the red carpet gets rolled out, all the VIPs are invited, the glasses, the trays of champagne and canapes go around, and there's extra staff on at that particular time because it's a VIP night, right? It's got to be amazing. It's got to look incredible. Add some more flowers in here and do this, right? make it the best possible night ever. And then you go back a year later and you see so much drift. And it's like, no, it should be like that every night almost, right? And if you do that, then you're going to be in a place where, you become the highest rated theme park in Australia and you can charge more aggressively for your ticket price, which goes straight down to the bottom line. And you're getting better results in terms of commercial, secondary spend. Adventure World's unique because it's always been, they've always allowed people to bring their own food. And so when I started, I think 73% of people were bringing an esky full of drinks, cold drinks and food and stuff because the food in the park was dreadful and it wasn't a really good value for money, right? It was terrible. So we put a lot of effort into, and I guess I draw my background in food and beverage as well to provide great quality, fare, food and drinks and keep the price down. And we increased the discount level for season pass members. So there were season pass members buying an amazing chicken tenderloin tiki burger with, Spanish onions and crushed avocado and chipotle mayonnaise and cheese with a milk, toasted bun for like $6.75, right? It's
Wow.
nothing. You barely get that at McDonald's. So suddenly the numbers of people bringing their own food drop because they realized they could get a great product. And we saw that, our view was the food and beverage should be an attraction in itself. It shouldn't be, when you go to McDonald's, I can't hear, I've said this. You go to McDonald's, you look at the photograph on the screen of the product, and then you open your box and look at it and go, oh my God,
I've been catfished.
it's like turning up for a blind date and, she doesn't look anything like the photographs on on your app. Huge disappointment. So we really wanted to make sure. I love food. I just love,
I'm with
there's
you on
never a
that one.
meal.
I'm here all the way for that one.
There's never a meal in my life, breakfast, lunch, or dinner, I don't put effort into flavor, texture, every, because I life's too short for boring food. I think that was one of the mantras of the sandwich chain. What's it? What? Pret a Manger. Pret a Manger. The Pret a Manger guys were the founders of it, first came up with that concept. Their ethos was life's too short for boring sandwiches.
Yeah, I can get on board with that.
Absolutely, I had to stop myself from swearing then. Absolutely effing right. Make it tasty. Life's short. Have some fun with it. I think this is a really important part too, because one of the things that I had a bit of time in Melbourne, but and I remember coming across this paper from a Melbourne university who'd done a study of five attractions in Melbourne. I think it was Melbourne Zoo, Luna Park, the aquarium, something else, a couple of Sovereign Hill maybe. And one of the key takeaways from this research paper was that it stuck with me and it's stuck with me ever since, and I use it over and over again. People who visit attractions value the interactions with the people that work at the attractions as much as, if not more, than the product. So I see a lot of operators going, yeah, I'm going to spend $20 million on new attraction, right? But how much money are you spending on the guest experience? How much money are you spending on training and getting the right employees and recognition and reward and all that kind of stuff to elevate the overall experience? Just not. And that research has been backed up by Disney's research. There's an annual theme park survey that comes out every January in the UK, name of which I can never remember, but it consistently says, I think 63% of the people who are surveyed, and they survey 1,000 people every year, say that the interactions with the people that work at the attraction or the theme park rather is the most important thing. And it just speaks to that sort of human respect piece. We're social animals. The whole respect, interaction, validating people. You are important to me. I'm going to be present with you. I'm going to look out for you. I'm going to ask you questions. I'm going to be curious about you. I'm going to be present. I'm actually going to make eye contact when I say, how's your day going? When you go to the supermarket checkout, my favorite when I go to the supermarket checkout is when I go at about 8:45, and bearing in mind that most people in Australia go to bed about 9, right? So if you go to the supermarket at 8:45, you're buying a couple of items and they go, enjoy the rest of your day. And you go, it's 8:45.
I'm going to
Not my,
bed.
like, I'm literally going to go home, put the stuff in the fridge in the cupboard, and might watch TV for 20 minutes, and then I'm done, or I'm going to bed. So it's a sort of that inauthenticity of, oh, I did just
I've got
trot
the
out the
same.
same line rather than say, hey, enjoy what's left of the day. That would be so much better because it would actually be real.
It's interesting because I think sometimes, and I don't blame staff team if you, for this, but the ethos is almost that they forget that theme park guests are guests. They are guests of the park, and and they are people who should be interacted with in a nice, friendly way. And if you're working out that part, you are welcoming a guest into your business, and you know, and they've paid for that experience, and they should be treated with respect to some extent. I mean, some guests will absolutely not deserve some respect because they will go and behave appallingly. But for the vast majority,
I always tell my team or when I'm consulting with people, I just you just accept that the 5% of the customers are going to be assholes, and just let that go, right? I've seen people trying to fight over £20, where, you know, as a refund, right? Somebody's kicking off, and just go, just give it to them, let them do their thing, right? And you focus on the 95% who are really good customers, because these people are going to drag you down in terms of your attitude towards customers.
Absolutely,
don't let that happen.
Yeah,
and learnings that I've had over the last 30 years, the one that's sort of gradually grown and grown and grown, is that importance around recruiting the right people. Because if you do recruit the right people, sure, you give them the right training, you give them the, you know, great inspiring inductions and recognition piece and all that, but they will do it for you. Like, if you pick the right people with the right disposition, the right attitude, they've had the right upbringing, there's something about them genetically, they're just naturally warm, lovely people. You won't have that problem in a theme park.
No.
They'll look after people, and you can turn your back. You can go on holiday for 2 weeks. They'll just keep doing it because you picked the right people.
Disney do it, don't they? And the Disney cast members is the perfect example. And I love hearing what you're saying. But in some ways, it's so frustrating as an enthusiast also to hear what you're saying, because we say these same things and we get told, you know nothing about running a theme park, you're just theme park enthusiasts. And we're like, yeah, but surely some of this experience is, don't rip me off with food. Give me some decent food in the park. Give me a decent experience. Get your rides running operationally if I've spent my money to be in the park. And they're like, you know nothing. You don't understand. And yet you're here with a non-Disney budget, having done exactly that and proved that it works. Yeah.
And that's right. And it's like, you know, that when people give me that excuse of, we should elevate our recruitment and recruit better people, but it's really hard around here. I go, it's really hard everywhere. It's hard in Perth. What you have to do then is double down on your efforts to curate that pool of people, the right pool of people, those lovely people. And that requires a lot of work, and then it requires a lot of attention to detail, like putting the advert together, making sure that you're connecting with the right people from a marketing sort of sense, making sure that you're giving every opportunity for those people to go, yes, I'm opting into this. I'm choosing to go and, you know, I'm interested. But you've got to work harder at it. And it's like gold, right? If five-star employees are like gold, you've got to go digging a little bit deeper to find it. If you can't find it straight away, I remember going to the first intake for casuals at Adventure World in the first year I was there. And they getting to the, I think they'd done three sessions, and it was a Sunday night, and I drove out there and I met the guys and I said, how's it going? And they were like looking forlorn, and they're like, we still need another 150 people. And I'm like, okay. What I want you to do, because you've got another one coming, that like in half an hour, these guys are going to turn up. Do not panic hire. Hold the line, right? You know that line in Gladiator when he's talking about, hold the line. Don't compromise. I said, don't worry about it. If you get to the end of the night and you still need another 75 people, we'll go back and we'll re-advertise and we'll book the, you know, the convention place where we've got all these people coming in for their auditions and the whole process. And yes, you'll have to probably work a little bit of extra time next weekend to get it done. But trust me, when you come out the other end and you've got a much better team of people, your life as a manager, your life as a team leader or a supervisor is going to be so much better. It's going to be so much easier and you will love it. And eventually they did and they got it. And then obviously we just, you know, kept going down that road. So that's, I think a lot of people spend 3% of their time in recruitment mode and 97% of their time trying to manage a problem they've recruited, where if they actually spent 5 or 6% of their time maybe on recruitment and getting it right and not compromising, they would be in a much better position. Because every activity you do as a leader, as a manager, then if you get the right people on board, gives you a higher return on investment. You know, there's inductions, training, reward and recognition, leadership. You just get much more out of them.
Yeah, it makes absolute total sense. I want to pick you up and I want to take you around every theme park in the UK and just listen to this man for a minute, will you? Just, he knows what he's talking about. I'm sure you'll be aware all those businesses have no doubt got their own challenges, and maybe some of them you could solve and maybe some of them you couldn't. But it is definitely interesting watching from the sidelines and hearing you talk about this stuff. And I guess what you're saying, from what I'm hearing, is a model that could be picked up and put into any, you know, not only attractions industry product, it could be picked up and it could put into anything where there's customer service. And
that's exactly what I do with my coaching consulting work. I've built the framework called ACE, Amazing Customer Experiences, and it's a 6-pillar model that takes the business from good to great. And it's, you know, it's leadership, it's ACE leadership, it's ACE recruitment, it's ACEing inductions, having inspiring inductions that really clarify for people exactly why we've chosen them and what we're expecting of them and what their role is. You know, telling them, for example, at Adventure World, we gave them absolute latitude to do whatever it takes without any regard to budget to fix a guest problem on the spot. And you'd see this group, I'd go to the inductions and tell these teams, present that they could do this, and you'd see these sort of 17, 18 year olds kind of looking at me going, what do you mean any budget? Like, really? And I go, yeah, I trust you. We've handpicked you because we think you're smart. We think you care. And if you need to go and replace the kid's ice cream because they've dropped it straight away without asking a supervisor or a team leader if they can do it and then take it back to them, you do it. If you want to go and spend $20 on a new Elmo because the kid's lost his Elmo in the park, which happened, and you need to go to Kmart and buy a new one and then deliver it around to his house because the two-year-old's, effectively his Elmo was like his comfort blanket and he was really upset, we did it, right? Mm. Nobody said, you spent $25 on, you know, a new Elmo and driving around there and petrol receipt. Just do it.
It all makes perfect sense, and I can see why you are successful at doing what you're doing. It's been fascinating chatting to you today. I don't really want to take too much of more of your time because I know, like I said, that you're a busy man. I'm sure there's a million other things that I could ask you and the listeners of the podcast could ask you, but I'm really grateful for you spending some time with us today. Before you go, though, I do have one question for you.
Just gotta ride it.
This is the question we ask every guest on the podcast. It's called Just Gotta Ride It. And it's where I put you on the spot and say, if you could only save one roller coaster in the world, which one are you going to save? Which one do we need to get on if we haven't ridden it already?
Oh my God. There's a wooden roller coaster at a flipping zoo in the Netherlands. No, not Netherlands, Sweden, sorry. That I went to a couple of years ago. Can't remember the name of it.
Kolmården?
Yes.
At Kolmården.
Yeah, come on. Their wooden roller coaster is insane. And it's primarily a zoo with rides and amazing shows. Their dolphin show is out of this world. The ride is sensational.
It's called Wildfire.
That's it. Yeah. Strongly recommend that as a wooden roller coaster, as a steel roller coaster. I don't know.
Don't fall into the trap. There'll be enthusiasm.
I quite like the Joker here at Movie World. I don't think it's actually called the Joker. It's just got Joker theming on it. I think it's called something else. But anyway, it's a really good steel roller coaster.
You can only pick one, Mark. I'm not having any liberties here.
Well, in that case, I'm going Wildfire then. Because that blew my mind as a wooden roller coaster. That was something special.
Yeah. Okay. We'll let the RMC Woody Steel Hybrid debate rage on in the background, which I'm sure it will. But I have not ridden that one, but I have heard a lot of people say the same, that it is.
If you get the chance, definitely go. And check out the shows. They're, like I said, the dolphin show is just insane. Beautiful.
Amazing. I'm going to have to put Sweden on my travel list immediately.
Yes.
And at some point I will get out to visit Australia. We had a chat before we started recording and I said the spiders are an issue for me. But you've reassured me that it's only snakes that I should be scared of when I visit a theme park in Australia.
No, even like I said to you earlier, I when I first arrived here, I was really scared about snakes. And then I learned about them and I realized they're not interested. If they get a chance, they'll slither away. They're very shy. They get very spooked quite easily. They just want to find a black hole. And so My what started out as an absolute fear of snakes has turned almost turned into curiosity. I kind of, when there's one around now, I will venture close to have a look because they're quite beautiful. They're quite beautiful creatures, and you know, sometimes I'm out in my garden here in Brisbane, and I think I look up at the trees and I'm just like scanning
Oh,
because
don't.
there's always a chance there could be a carpet
Don't.
python or something like
No,
that.
come
And
on.
no, honestly, because there's plenty of animals. There's lots of gecko lizards and shit like that
I don't mind them. That's fine.
but that's their food, right?
Oh, okay,
So
fine.
if you're seeing lizards, you're probably there's a snake not far away
I'm not
on
on
that
board with
note.
that. I can get on board with koala bears,
Yeah.
but Australian beasts.
But they're smelly.
I'll
They're
take
cute, but
it.
they're smelly.
I'll take it over
Yeah.
a spider. I've seen the TikToks of the spiders in the corners of the room, which are bigger than my face.
I got to tell you this too, right? There's an Aussie area at Aussie Wildlife Area at Adventure World, and they've got kangaroos down there. And one day, one of the small kangaroos got out and was in the main pathway, right? So there's like ring fence either side, and there's a couple of operations guys down the bottom, and I'm at the top, and it's heading towards me, and the guys are like yelling, "Go, Mark! It's coming! Grab it!" Right? And I go to grab it, and I was born and raised on a farm, right? So I'm quite used to wrestling animals. And this flipping, like short kangaroo just bounced right over the top of my head. It was like a slow motion thing. I just like looked up and went, "Oh my God!" Amazing, just amazing. Anyway,
Yeah,
that's Australia
okay.
for you.
I'd like to see a baby kangaroo. I can get on board with that. Not a real life one, though. Not a big, fully grown one. I've seen them. They're muscly. They're scary.
Not the reds. The greys are all right. The reds you've got to be a bit careful.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yeah,
Yeah, I've seen.
they
Yeah,
can get a bit
feisty.
feisty. Yeah,
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 calm
yeah. You
down.
don't
You're a
like, and they're
kangaroo.
big. Yeah,
Yeah,
they got like they look like they've gone to the gym. They're all like
they do.
pecs
They
and
are ripped.
They'll kick
Yeah.
you, they'll punch you, they'll yeah.
Okay. Well, like that sounds fun.
Go.
If I ever get to Australia, I'll give you a call and we go and visit Adventure World together, and you can go and cast your eye over
Yeah.
how it's doing now.
100%. That'd be great.
That'd be
You,
fun.
me, and Francis.
Yes. Oh, can you imagine the banter that day would be next level. Mark, again, it's been brilliant chatting to you. Thanks so much for sharing all your insight with
Likewise.
us. We've
Yeah, it's
loved
a pleasure.
listening to you. And good luck with all your consulting, and hopefully the word of what you do will spread to theme parks around the world, because I do think it's genuinely important for us as enthusiasts and just regular guests as well. I think it's really important to theme park survival. We will be back next week on Parkcast. If you haven't already, do hit subscribe so you'll get that notification every time we release a new episode. And if you have enjoyed today, please give us a rating. I'd love to hear your reviews on it. Until next time, though, we've been Parkcast.
Podcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.